Pungushu was silent for the time it took Mark to spoon a slop of maize porridge and bully beef into the lid of the pannikin and take it to the Zulu. "Eat," he commanded, and sat cross-legged opposite him with his own plate in his lap. "What you say is true," Pungushu spoke thoughtfully. "When I was a child of your age," Mark noted the barb, but let it pass, "there were elephants in this valley, great bulls with teeth as long as a throwing spear, and there were many lions, herds of buffalo like the great king's cattle." He broke off. "They have gone. Soon what is left will go also." "Is that a good thing?" Mark asked. "It is neither a good thing nor a bad thing," Pungushu shrugged and began to eat. "It is merely the way of the world, and there is little profit in pondering it." They finished eating in silence, and Mark cleared the plates and brought coffee, which Pungushu waved away. "Drink it," snapped Mark. "You must have it to cleanse the blood from your water." He gave Pungushu one of his cigarettes, and the Zulu carefully broke off the brown cork tip before putting it between his lips. He wrinkled his broad, flat nose at the insipid taste, for he was accustomed to the ropey black native tobacco, but he would not belittle a man's hospitality by making comment. "When it is all gone, when the great emptiness comes here to this valley, what will become of you, O jackal?" Mark asked. "I do not understand your question." "You are a man of the Silwani. You are a great hunter. Your life is yoked to the Silwani, as the herdsman is yoked to his cattle. What will become of you, O mighty hunter, when all your cattle are gone?" Mark realized that he had reached the Zulu. He saw his nostrils flare, and something burn up brightly within him. But he waited while Pungushu considered the proposition at great length and in every detail. "I will go to Igoldi," said Pungushu at last. "I will go to the gold mines and become rich. They will put you to work deep in the earth, where you cannot see the sun nor feel the wind, and you will break rocks, just as you go now to do at the kraal of King Georgi." Mark saw the repugnance flit across the Zulu's face. "I will go to Tekwini," Pungushu changed his mind. "I will go to Durban and become a man of much consequence." "In Tekwini you will breathe the smoke of the cane mills into your lungs, and when the fat Babu overseer speaks to you, you will reply, 'Yebo Inkosi, yes, master.'" This time the repugnance on the Zulu's face was deeper still, and he smoked his cigarette down to a tiny sliver of paper and ash, which he pinched out between thumb and forefinger. "Jamela," he said sternly, "you speak words that trouble a man." Mark knew well that the big Zulu's injury was more serious than his stoic acceptance of it would indicate. It was womanly to show pain. It would be a long time before he was ready to make the journey by sidecar over the rough tracks and rutted, dusty roads to the police station and magistrate's court at Ladyburg. Mark put him into the small lean-to tool shed that he had built onto the far wall of the mule stables. It was dry and cool and had a sturdy floor with a Yale padlock. He used blankets from Marion's chest and the mattress she had been saving for the children's room, despite her protests. "But he's a native, dear." Every evening he took the prisoner's meal down to him in the pannikin, inspected the wound and dressed it afresh. Then, while he waited for Pungushu to eat, he sat on the top step in the doorway to the shed, and they smoked a cigarette while they talked. "If the valley belongs now to King Georgi, how is it that you build your house here, plant your gardens, and graze your mules?"
"I am the king's man," Mark explained.
"You are an Nduna?"
Pungushu paused with a spoon of food halfway to his mouth and stared at Mark incredulously.
"You are one of the king's councillors?"
"I am the keeper of the royal hunt," Mark used the old Zulu title, and Pungushu shook his head sadly.
My father's father was once the keeper of the royal hunt. But he was a man of great consequence, with 2 dozen wives, a man who had fought in 12 wars and killed so many enemies that his shield was as thick with oxtails as there is grass on the hills in springtime."
The oxtail was the decoration which the king grants a warrior to adorn his shield when he has distinguished himself in battle. Pungushu finished his meal and added simply,
"King Shaka knew better than to send a child to do a man's work."
The next evening, Mark saw that the wound was healing cleanly and swiftly. The man's tremendous fitness and strength were responsible for that. He was able to sit cross-legged now, and there was a new jauntiness in the way he held his head. It would be sooner than Mark had thought that Pungushi would be fit enough to make the journey to Ladyburg, and Mark felt an odd sinking feeling of regret.
"A King Georgi is doubtlessly a great, wise, and all-seeing king," Pungushi opened the evening's debate. "But then does he wait until sundown to begin work that should have been started at dawn? If he wanted to avoid the great emptiness in this valley, his father should have begun the work."
"The king's affairs are many, in far countries. He must rely on Indunas to advise him, who are not as wise or all-seeing," Mark explained.
"The Abelungu, the white men, are like greedy children, grabbing up handfuls of food they cannot eat. Instead, they smear it over their faces."
"There are greedy and ignorant black men also," Mark pointed out, "some who even kill leopards with steel traps for their fur."
"To sell to the greedy white men, to dress their ignorant women,"
Pungushi agreed. "And that makes the score deuce," Mark thought, as he gathered up the empty pannikins. The next evening, Pungushi seemed sad, as at the time of leave-taking.
"You have given me much on which I must think heavily," he said.
"You will have much time to do so," Mark agreed, "in between the breaking of rocks." And Pungushi ignored the reference.
"There is weight in your words for one who is still young enough to be herding the cattle," he qualified the compliment.
"Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings," Mark translated into Zulu. And Pungushi nodded solemnly. And in the morning, he was gone. He had opened the thatch at the back of the roof and wriggled through the small hole. He had taken his kaross and left Marion's blankets neatly folded on the mattress. He had tried for the steel springtrap, but Mark had locked it in the kitchen, so he had left it and gone northwards in the night. Mark was furious for so misjudging his prisoner's recovery, and he muttered darkly as he plunged along after him on the Trojan. "This time I'm going to shoot the bastard on sight," he promised, and realized at that moment that Pungushi had backtracked on him. He had to dismount and laboriously unravel the confused trail. Half an hour later, Pungushi led him into the river, and it was well after noon when he at last found where the Zulu had left the water, stepping lightly on a fallen log. He finally lost the cold spoor on the rocky ground on the far rim of the valley, and it was almost midnight when he rode wearily back to the thatched cottage. Marion had his dinner ready, and 10 gallons of hot bath water bubbling on the fire. 6 weeks later, Pungushi returned to the valley. Mark sat astounded on the stoop of the cottage and watched him come. He walked with the long, gliding stride that showed he was fully recovered from his wound. He wore the beaded loincloth and the jackal skin cloak over his shoulders. He carried 2 of the short-shafted stabbing assegai with the broad steel blades, and his wives followed at a respectable distance behind him. There were 3 of them. They were bare-breasted, with the tall clay headdress of the Zulu matron. The senior was of the same age as her husband, but her dugs were flat and empty as leather pouches, and she had lost her front teeth. The youngest wife was a child still in her teens, a pretty plump little thing with jolly melon breasts and a fat brown infant on her hip. Every wife carried an enormous bundle on her head, balancing it easily without use of hands, and they were followed by a gaggle of naked and half-naked children. Like their mothers, the little girls each carried a headload, the size of it directly proportional to the age and stature of the bearer. The smallest, perhaps 4 years of age, carried a beer gourd the size of a grapefruit, echoing faithfully the straight, erect carriage and swaying buttocks of her seniors. Mark counted 7 sons and 6 daughters.
"I see you, Jamela." Pungushi paused below the stoop.
"I see you also, Pungushi," Mark acknowledged cautiously. And the Zulu squatted down comfortably on the lowest step. His wives settled down at the edge of Marion's garden, politely out of earshot. The youngest wife gave one of her fat breasts to the infant, and he suckled lustily.
"It will rain tomorrow," said Pungushi, "unless the wind goes into the north, in which case it will not rain again until the full moon."
"That is so," Mark agreed.
Rain now would be good for the grazing. It will bring the Silwani down from the Portuguese territory beyond the Pongola.
Mark's astonishment had now given way to lively curiosity. There is talk in the villages, common word among all the people.
That has only recently come to my ears, Pungushi went on airily.
It is said that Jamela, the new keeper of the royal hunt of King Georgie, is a mighty warrior who has slain great multitudes of the king's enemies in the war beyond the seas.
The jackal paused and then went on.
Albeit he is still unbearded and green as the first flush of the springtime grass.
Is that the word? Mark inquired politely.
It is said that King Georgie has granted Jamela a black oxtail to wear on his shield.
A black oxtail is the highest honour and might loosely be considered the equivalent of an M.M.
I am also a warrior, Pungushi pointed out. I fought with Bombata at the gorge, and afterwards the soldiers came and took away my cattle. This is how I became a man of Silwani and a mighty hunter.
Well, we're brothers of the spear, then, Mark conceded. But now I'll make ready my Isidududu, my motorcycle, so that we may ride to Ladyburg and speak with the magistrate there of matters of great interest to all of us.
Jamela,
the Zulu shook his head grievingly, like a father with an obtuse son.
You aspire to be a man of the Silwani. You aspire to fill the great emptiness. And yet, who will there be to teach you? Who will open your eyes to see and your ears to hear if I am in the kraal of King Georgie breaking his rocks?
You have come to help me? Mark asked. You and your beautiful fat wives, your brave sons and nubile daughters?
It is even so.
This is a noble thought, Mark conceded.
I am Zulu, of royal blood, Pungushi agreed. Also, my fine steel trap was stolen from me, even as my cattle were stolen, thus making me a poor man once more.
I see, Mark nodded. It remains only for me to put out of my mind the business of leopard skins and dead buffalo.
It is even so.
Doubtless I will also find it in my heart to pay you for this help and advice.
That also is so. What size is the coin in which you will be paid?
Pungushi shrugged with disinterest.
I am a royal Zulu, not a Hindu trader haggling in the marketplace. The coin will be just and fair, he paused delicately, always bearing in mind the multitude of my beautiful wives, my many brave sons, and the host of nubile daughters, all of whom have unbelievable appetites.
Mark had to remain silent, not trusting himself to speak, until he controlled the violent urge to burst out laughing. He spoke again solemnly, but with laughter rippling his belly muscles.
In what style will you address me, Pungushi? When I speak, will you answer, Yebo Inkosi, yes, master?
Pungushi stirred restlessly, and an expression flitted across the broad, smooth features, like a fastidious eater who has just discovered a large fat worm on his plate.
I will call you Jamela, he said. And when you speak as you have just spoken, I will answer, Jamela, that is a great stupidity.
In what style will I address you? Mark inquired politely, fighting his mirth.
You will call me Pungushi, for the jackal is the cleverest and most cunning of all the Silwani, and it is necessary for you to be reminded of this from time to time.
Then something happened that Mark had not seen before. Pungushi smiled. It was like the breakthrough of the sun on a grey, overcast day. His teeth were big and perfect and white, and the smile stretched so wide that it seemed his face might tear. Mark could no longer contain it. He laughed out loud, beginning with a strangled chuckle. Hearing it, Pungushi laughed also, a great ringing bell of laughter. The two of them laughed so long and hard that the wives fell silent and watched in amazement, and Marion came out onto the stoop.
What is it, dear?
He could not answer her, and she went away shaking her head at the craziness of men. At last they both fell silent, exhausted with mirth,
and Mark gave Pungushi a cigarette, from which he carefully broke the cork tip. They smoked in silence for nearly a minute, and then suddenly, without warning, Mark let out another uncontrolled guffaw, and it started them off again. The cords of sinew stood out on Pungushi's neck like columns of carved ebony, and his mouth was a deep pink cavern lined with perfect white teeth. He laughed until the tears ran down his face and dripped from his chin, and when he lost his breath, he let out a great whistling snort like a bull hippo breaking surface, and he wiped the tears away with his thumb, and he said, and slapped his thigh like a pistol shot between each fresh paroxysm of laughter. Mark ended it by reaching out his shaking right hand, and Pungushi took it in a reverse grip, panting and heaving still. "Pungushi, I am your man," Mark sobbed, "and I, Jamela, am yours."